You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, no mai hari mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā for Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. Fi Akine coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the mega strike happening tomorrow, the Labour Party releasing their first major policy ahead of next year's general election, and the government moving forward with their Roads of National Significance program. I also spoke with Paul Talon, a senior lecturer in US history from the University of Auckland, to discuss the recent court win by US President Donald Trump and his attempts to deploy the National Guard in democratic cities. And producer Vihan spoke to the president of the New Zealand Association of Optometrists, Hayden Trianor, and a couple of university students about the government's proposed changes to the driver license system and what the reduction of eye exams needed for Class 1 license holders means for the future of New Zealand drivers. Manny, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with Fleur Fitzsimmons, the National Secretary of the Public Service Association, to discuss the upcoming mega strikes and why so many unions are facing the same problem.
He aho o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Toku pātohi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakihere roki roki mā runga i te bai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
On Monday, the Labour Party announced their first major policy ahead of next year's general election, which is titled the Future Fund. Although Labour didn't include many specifications about the policy, the aim is to invest in New Zealand businesses that are inventive and resourceful. They also announced the fund would begin with a $200 million investment. We also discussed the government's decision to move ahead with its Roads of National Significance, as they've allocated $1.2 billion worth of funding to the program, of which $550 million is being used to buy properties for the project to move forward. But first, we discuss the upcoming mega strike from the unions, which is happening tomorrow.
It was announced yesterday that ACC workers had voted to join the mega strike tomorrow, where tens of thousands of teachers, doctors, and nurses will walk off the job, as part of a demand for better pay and working conditions. Along with this, Public Service Minister Judith Collins wrote an open letter where she expressed regret on behalf of the government for what she described as a coordinated attack and politically motivated. To begin, how does the Green Party respond to Judith Collins' claim that these strikes are a coordinated attack against the current government?
It is the current government that is refusing to provide safe working conditions for healthcare workers, decent pay for teachers. And it should come as no surprise that workers have had enough and are choosing to strike. What is really concerning as well is to see the minister straight up lie about the fact that PPTA wasn't keen to discuss pay and working conditions, and twisting the words of the union to make political attacks on workers just reeks of a government that is ruling for the wealthy few as opposed to everyday people.
Would you say that the demands that the unions are asking for are a fair request?
Absolutely. Workers across the board are struggling with the cost of living crisis, and for example, healthcare workers are facing unsafe staffing levels that is putting patients at risk in our hospitals. At the same time, the government needs to recognize if they want a world-class education system, we need to value our teachers, pay them well, and actually have enough staff so that they can adequately do their job. And so I think to me the issue that the government is facing is that they're simply not valuing workers. They're expecting workers to be paid less than what they are worth. And so this is why we're standing in solidarity with countless of workers that are taking action to fight for better pay and conditions. And this is the economy that we're fighting for in the Greens, one that actually values our healthcare and education workers and everyday people so that they get what they deserve.
What do you make of the government's defensive stance in these strikes and negotiations that have gone on for a long time now?
it's indicative of a government that simply does not value workers. I mean, at the same time that they've given billions of dollars to landlords on military equipment, hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies to fossil fuel companies, they're telling everyday nurses, allied health workers, care and support workers, teachers, firefighters, that they're not worth of safe working conditions and decent pay. This is a government that has taken political choices to hand out billions of dollars to the wealthy mates while leaving everyday workers struggling with the cost of living.
Many ministers in the government have questioned the union's priorities, specifically when it comes to Palestine. How do you respond to this?
Once again, we saw a minister straight up lying and claiming that one of the union's top priorities on discussions was Palestine, when they have already clearly debunked the fact that they did want to engage in pay and working conditions. And also, at the same time, unions are able to raise issues that are of national and international significance. We have seen how unions across the world have stood in solidarity against the genocide, which I think is a pretty low bar that we should be expecting most organizations and politicians to be against the genocide. But I think what is most concerning is having a minister that has chosen to run a smear campaign full of misinformation over the reality that PPTA, as well as other unions, have consistently been trying to raise pay and working conditions. And instead, the minister, rather than acknowledging that, has instead chosen to use public funding to run ads against the workers that the unions represent.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon suggested the government would be more willing to accept the union's demands if the economy were in a better position. Do you think that this is a fair stance?
Absolutely not, because they have chosen to hand out billions of dollars to landlords. They have chosen to hand out hundreds of millions of dollars to fossil fuel companies. They have made political decisions to increase the wealth of the wealthy few as opposed to everyday workers that actually sustain our economy. This is just cover that the Prime Minister is giving himself to basically mask the fact that he does not value workers and everyday people, and politicians are always able to make decisions on what the economy looks like, and the Greens are fighting for an economy that works for all workers, not just the wealthy few.
All right, moving on to the next topic. On Tuesday, the Labour Party announced their first policy ahead of next year's general election. A future fund would be set up alongside the existing super fund with the idea to invest in New Zealand businesses that are inventive and resourceful. The fund would begin with a $200 million investment with aims to help New Zealanders into work. My next question is, what was the Green Party's reaction to this announcement by Labour, and is this a policy that the Green Party would support?
We still need to tax wealth, and the Greens have a plan to create tens of thousands of jobs, and we've demonstrated we want to prioritise those jobs and the kind of strategies we want to put in place, particularly in the manufacturing and construction sector. I think we welcome Labour to the party when it comes to the notion of the government taking an active role of creating jobs, but there are not enough details yet for us to make a judgment as to whether we'll be in support of that policy. I think some of the most important things that the government could be doing to raise the revenue to invest in New Zealand assets in our economy would be to tax wealth and put that money to create local jobs and to, for example, create a manufacturing sector so that we're not exporting raw materials to be processed overseas and then having to import those more expensive materials back into the country.
Can you understand why critics are sceptical about the lack of detail in the plan released by Labour?
I can see why people would want to know the details. And what we are very, very clear is that what we are fighting for is to tax wealth and to not, most political parties have done, avoid the question of what is our tax reform plan. And this is why we are fighting again to create tens of thousands of jobs in the manufacturing construction sector, as well as in the area of jobs for nature, which has been really important in Auckland to restore our streams, to protect our cities against floods. And that is what we are fighting for. Labour will, of course, have to explain further detail of their policies that they're trying to sell. But we're very clear that when we sit down at the negotiating table, we'll be fighting hard to get our policies across.
Can you see the potential of this plan by Labour as an adequate step forward to rebuilding the economy?
I think what we need to not avoid is having the conversation on tax. And for us, we're really clear that we have a plan to create jobs. And we've put quite a bit of work into substantiating the details of that policy. And when we sit down with Labour, we know that the greater our party vote is, the more chances we'll have at getting our policies across once we change this government.
Labor seem to be specifically interested in investing in companies involved in renewable energy. What do you think of that?
Well, we've long supported greater investment in renewable energy. I think one of the key things, though, that we could be doing is making sure that we tackle the conversation around the behavior of gentailers, which ultimately are leading some of the issues when it comes to high electricity prices. And that is why, for us, our priority is for publicly owned programs that are not creating more corporates that end up taking their profits to just wealthy shareholders to, for example, solarize our schools, our marae, our hospitals, and to provide solar energy for communities across the board. And so that is a way of creating jobs, but also lowering electricity bills as well.
And Labor leader Chris Hipkins believes that the benefits of this policy will help young New Zealanders into work and slow down current youth migration. Do you agree with him on that?
Well, we'll need to see the details of what that policy looks like and how many jobs will be created. Once again, what I am really clear is that what we are fighting for is having a green jobs guarantee to create 40,000 jobs. And we hope that Labor can support that policy. As we know, particularly in the manufacturing industry, it's really important that we stop exporting raw materials only to import products that have been processed overseas. We used to make things in this country. And so what we are fighting for is our own policy once we sit at the negotiating table.
Moving on to the last topic, the government announced that they will spend more than $500 million buying up property so that it can push ahead with its roads of national significance. Transport Minister Chris Bishop also announced an allocation of $1.2 billion worth of funding had been allocated to get the projects to the next stage of development. What is the Green Party's response to this?
The government is not adequately erasing issues of congestion by putting a lot of money into roads and not investing a proportionate amount on issues like public transport, which we know will lead to lower congestion and lower transport costs for people across the country. And that includes investment into issues like interregional rail. The key thing as well is that it's quite rich for the government to be really okay with buying private property for public projects when they were so critical of the past government buying private housing for public housing projects. And so I think the government needs to confront their hypocrisy when it comes to the acquisition of private land for public works. And we call on the government to put greater investment into public transport, which is what we know and the evidence shows will actually reduce congestion and transport costs for people, including people who still need to use cars.
Just going back to the strikes quickly, how can the Prime Minister use a weak economy as the reason for not accepting the union's demands and then simultaneously pass a plan such as this, which allocates more than $1 billion?
Once again, this all shows that there are political decisions and the Prime Minister is choosing to make decisions to invest in infrastructure projects that, for example, will lower congestion at a much smaller rate than public transport projects would. They're quite happy to give billions of dollars to landlords while telling healthcare workers that they do not deserve safe working conditions or better pay. And again, this is just such a prime example of why we have a government that is ruling for the wealthy and not everyday people.
Transport Minister Chris Bishop says the Roads of National Significance program will redress New Zealand's infrastructure deficit and build jobs and growth for Kiwis. Do you agree with him?
Well, the key thing is that our infrastructure deficit is largely, and when it comes to transport, isn't the public transport space. I think any New Zealander who will be looking at images or has travelled, you know, to overseas cities will know that our major cities and towns are lagging behind having adequate interregional rail, adequate city rail networks. And this is where the investment should lie in, because this is what has been shown to reduce congestion, transport prices for workers, which make up a huge proportion of the everyday cost that people face. And so I think the government has its priorities upside down by prioritizing expensive roads over actually more affordable, more efficient, and more climate-friendly projects like rail, which would actually deliver greater benefits to reducing congestion in our cities.
And lastly, do you think the majority of the New Zealand public are happy that this program is moving forward?
I think what most people want to see is just less congestion on the roads and a lower cost of transport. And I think most people will not be supportive of the fact that the government has chosen to go ahead with extremely expensive projects over, for example, an greater investment into public transport and the things that actually help people do well, like paying our teachers, our nurses, and our allied health workers and care and support workers what they deserve.
And that was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the upcoming mega strike, the Labour Party's first policy announcement for next year's general election, and the government moving forward with the Roads of National Significance program.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Wire.
Tomorrow, we are set to see the largest strikes in potentially the last 40 years as separate unions representing nurses, teachers and many more come together to put pressure on the government to take their negotiations seriously. In total, it'll likely hit around 100,000 Kiwis pushing for better working conditions. Frequent in their demands are requests for better pay that has been eroded by the inflation of the past few years, as well as safer staffing levels as many professionals seeking better conditions vacate the New Zealand workforce for Australia, leaving our hospitals, schools and workplaces woefully understaffed. To discuss tomorrow's mega strike, I spoke with Fleur Fitzsimmons, the National Secretary of the Public Service Association, on why so many unions are facing the same problem.
For our listeners out of the loop, could you give us an overview of the strike? What are the outcomes you'd like to see specifically for the PSA?
Yeah, there's strikes all over New Zealand involving PSA members who work in allied health, people who are mental health workers, public health nurses. We've also got workers who work on the data and digital side of Te Whatu Ora, people who do the policy work, auditors, and also people who work at ACC. All of them are finding that they're not making the progress they need in their collective bargaining and really are left with no choice but to take this industrial action tomorrow. It's going to be a big day.
Right, and there's a lot of different unions, more than just the PSA, coming together at this moment with all these separate unions coming together at the same time. It speaks to there being a shared issue between the unions. Do you buy that? Is there a singular symptom that can be addressed here?
Well, I think it does show the frustration with collective bargaining in all of these different workforces. And the one thing they have in common is that they're funded by the government. So I reject these claims by the government that it's not political. Funding of health and education is a political choice, and the government have the power to settle these disputes. They just need to come to the bargaining table with a fair pay offer and an offer which recognises the important professional issues these groups are raising. If you look at mental health workers, they turn up for work every day with a risk of violence and assaults against them. That's not good for them, it's not good for patients, and we want to see a response from government that keeps these workers safe, that ensures safe staffing, but also gives them a pay increase that is fair so that them and their families don't have to go backwards.
How has the coordination happened between these separate unions?
Basically what's happened is that each of these unions are not making the progress that they need to make in their respective collective bargaining. So strike ballots have been held at every workforce, and overwhelmingly workers have endorsed this program of strike action across New Zealand. Now, no worker wants to take strike action. No one does it lightly. It's a decision that's come to after a lot of consideration and attempts to settle disputes through collective bargaining. In some of our cases, we've been in bargaining for over a year, and we're still not seeing the kind of progress that these workers need and that New Zealand and them deserve.
Is there any specifically striking things that the unions would want that the government should be able to give, and it's striking that they aren't?
Look, I think what we really need to see is a commitment from government to engage in good faith bargaining, to listen to these workforces and respect these workers. Hear what they're saying. Don't dismiss their concerns as unaffordable or out of touch. Listen carefully to what health workers are saying. Listen carefully to what teachers are saying. Listen to what ACC workers are saying, particularly about their workplace culture, and consider how it can be addressed instead of sort of throwing political mud or playing games in the media.
In reference to the ACC one, there's been reports about a toxic culture and there's been a turnover in executives. Could you speak on that briefly?
Yeah, we're really disappointed in the culture review at ACC not being implemented. A review came out, it was done by Philippa Muir. She's a very well-respected lawyer. She looked carefully about what's going on at ACC, tried to understand what's driving some of the discontent among their workforce. And really, there were a number of things that came out of that review. One of them was that they have an old-fashioned and hostile attitude towards workers and unions. Now, that's something that ACC could address immediately. But what did they do instead? They issued a statement to all staff which said flexible work as you currently know it will be ending in December, with no consultation, no proper consideration of what arrangements people have in place at the moment or the basis on which they were employed and the commitments made to workers around flexible work. That sort of thing adds to a problematic culture. It doesn't show workers that the employer wants to work with them and understand their issues and improve the culture. And that's one of the key reasons why that workforce is now taking strike action.
Is that where you feel unions can really fit in as well, as spokespeople for workers when they don't feel like they can, or even if they do feel like they can, it gives the voices space to speak?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people join unions so that they can collectively have a say in their work and their workplace and their terms and conditions of employment. And what employers, if they want to work constructively with unions, should do is respect workers, respect unions, listen to what unions are saying about what's going on in workplaces, how solutions can be found, and then we can all move forward together instead of needing to take what is unfortunately quite disruptive industrial action.
And in terms of numbers, how significant is this upcoming strike going to be?
The strike is going to be historic. We're not only going to see about 100,000 workers all over New Zealand take strike action, but what we're also seeing is huge support from the community. We know a number of people who are saying, how can I help? How can I support? Can I come to a rally? What can I do? And so, you know, we really welcome that. It's a great show of solidarity, really, from the community towards the striking workers.
And if people do want to support the strikes, how can they turn out?
Well, there's lots of ways you can support. You can take to social media, share your messages. There are rallies going to be all over New Zealand. We're just working through the logistics of them because of some unfortunate weather events. But there are lots of opportunities for people to come along, join the rallies, and, as I say, express their support in social media. And we've already seen an overwhelming number of messages come through of solidarity and support.
Finally, is there anything you'd like to add at the end of all this?
I just want to call on the government to come to the bargaining table with a decent offer which takes workers and their families forward, which addresses the important issues that workers are raising about how work is done in workplaces, and means that we can settle this dispute before Christmas so that people can get on with their important work.
Fleur Fitzsimmons, thank you very, very much. Good luck out there.
That was the National Secretary for the Public Service Association, Fleur Fitzsimmons, on the mega strike tomorrow. We'll be right back after the short break. Keep it on the B.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the harbour bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost. The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. right here on 95BFM.
Do you think we'll continue to see these actions from Trump throughout the rest of his presidency?
Who knows what Trump is going to do?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. A couple of weeks ago on The Wire, we spoke to Paul Talon, a senior lecturer in US history at the University of Auckland, to discuss President Trump's move to send the National Guard troops into Portland, Oregon, being blocked by an Oregon judge. At the time, the judge had ruled that the president had overstepped his authority.
Yesterday, President Trump claimed a key victory in his efforts to deploy the National Guard in Democratic cities, as a divided three-judge panel decided he is allowed to deploy federal troops into the city, marking an important U-turn in the previous ruling. It's now being reported that Trump now has plans to deploy the National Guard in San Francisco as his next target. To discuss the importance of this decision when it comes to President Trump's remaining time in office and the impact on democracy in the United States, we caught up with Paul Talon once again. How significant is this victory for Trump?
It is significant in that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled overturning Karen J. Emmergut of the Federal District Court, her ban on the deployment of Oregon National Guardsmen in the state of Oregon. So in the short term, this is it's a victory for the president, seemingly giving the president the green light to deploy the National Guard. That said, of course, the attorneys for the state of Oregon have filed for what is called an en banc hearing by the circuit court, which means that the entire court, that is all the judges for that court, would sit together in panel to hear an appeal. So there's still some time left in the game, but at the moment it is a victory for the president.
Do you think this decision is a one-off, or will this be consistent from now on if Trump continues to send the National Guard into Democratic cities?
Well, I don't. Put it this way, this issue is working its way up the federal judiciary. And depending on whether or not the Ninth Circuit Court does agree to hear an en banc hearing, that is to hear the case again, that could go one of two ways, for or against the administration. And if it goes for, then I would expect another appeal, possibly to the U.S. Well, it would be to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would expect that then that would be the final stop. And whichever way the U.S. Supreme Court would rule, if it does agree to take a case, would be very significant at the constitutional level.
Given the lack of reason for President Trump to send the National Guard into most of these cities, does this court ruling undermine democracy in the U.S.?
Put it this way, it's depending on how you see these issues, it's a debatable issue. The significance of this decision, as I see it, really turns on the majority in the Ninth Circuit agreeing, so it seems to me, with the administration's argument that the courts must give a great deal of deference to the president's determination when and under what conditions to federalize, that is, and to use the National Guard. So the two judges that overturned the district court's ban appear to agree with that line of argument. And it goes on the following logic. It appears to me that the president has the ability to determine when circumstances warrant that federalizing of the National Guard. And what is more, that all of those circumstances might not be public. They might be secret to the administration, and that the administration, the president, must be allowed that deference to make that call. On the other hand, the dissenting judge, Susan Graber, disagrees with that on the presumptive broader arguments that there is a state of, a state of war, as the president claims, in Oregon, which at the moment appears to be patently not the case. And this is where the dissenting judge says that there is no plausible grounds here, and that this is actually quite a dangerous constitutional precedent. So, again, it depends on which way you look at it. And this, in turn, goes to a longer-standing issue in the U.S. political and governing system between the authority and power of the executive versus the other branches of government, the judiciary and the Congress. And again, depending on how you see things, it is or is not a danger to democracy.
Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield spoke out against the current ruling, saying that if this is allowed, Trump has unilateral power and the U.S. is on a dangerous path. Do you agree with him?
As a historian, as opposed to my personal view, I would say this. Certainly, that line of argument suggests that this decision stands as a dire, if not existential, threat to democracy. Speaking as a historian, though, this issue between the power and authority of the executive branch versus the other branches goes back almost to the very beginnings of the Republic. It actually reminds me in some ways of Andrew Jackson in the 1830s, who was at the time referred to as King Andrew the First, and he was a very divisive president, and interestingly, stands as the current president's, one of his favorite presidents, in fact. But at that time, Andrew Jackson was the first president to use the veto to block a act of Congress, which at the time was viewed as unconstitutional and undemocratic. And so fast forward to the president, to the present, with concerns about an imperial presidency since the second half of the 20th century is gathering more power unto itself. What we have at the moment is the latest chapter in a longer story of what should be the relative powers and authority of the respective branches of government.
Trump's next move will most likely be to deploy the National Guard in San Francisco after it was suggested by multiple tech billionaires. When justifying this, Trump said the difference between this situation and other cities was that he thought they wanted the National Guard in San Francisco, even though San Francisco has reported their lowest homicide rates since 1954. What's your reaction to this?
Sounds a lot like Chicago, where I'm from. Speaking as more of a commentator, now an observer, what it appears to me is that the president is claiming conditions of civil unrest and disorder to justify the deployment of National Guard to cities that he doesn't like. That is, cities which have Democratic Party governments and cities which have quite publicly, in many cases, opposed the president in his policies with regard to the deployment of ICE agents and immigration deportation.
Do you think we're currently on a path towards Trump running for office again in 2028?
Too soon to call. That is one of the big questions hanging over us. Trump himself has been a bit coy on that topic, but I would say this, that if Trump rise to or determines to stand, then we do have a constitutional issue because, and forgive me, I can't recall my amendment at the moment, president is not allowed to stand for more than 2 terms.
And that was the University of Auckland's Paul Talon on President Trump's recent court victory and why it could undermine democracy in the United States. We'll be right back after a short break.
Is because that's the big deal here. Dolphin orgies.
The Wire. The government is looking to introduce a raft of reforms to the driver license system, officially called the graduated driver licensing system. The government aims to make getting a full driver's license easier and cheaper for New Zealanders, which is why one of the proposed changes to the system includes scrapping the full license test. However, it is also calling for reduced eye exams for Class 1 license holders, saying repeated eye exams don't have any significant benefit on safety. I spoke to the New Zealand Association of Optometrists President Hayden Trainer about his views on the reduction of eye exams. Just tell me a bit about yourself. How long have you been the president of the NZAO?
So to give you full background on myself, so I'm an optometrist. I work in a practice called Frith and Laird Optometrists in Manurewa. I've been here for 16 years. I have been part of the NZAO, the New Zealand Association of Optometrists Council, for 4 years and have been president for the last 2 years. I also sit on the Eye Health Clinical Network.
So now, as you've heard with National's new proposal with the whole sort of reform with the driver license system, they have also proposed a reduction in the number of eye exams. So can you just sort of tell us what would this impact of the decrease in eye exams be for young drivers?
Our association has made a submission to the government on this, and yeah, we do have some concerns over the reduction in number of eye tests, because the proposal is that when you have your first apply for your licence, which for most people will be as a teenager, if you pass that, then your next vision check as part of a driver's licence renewal wouldn't be until you turned 45, whereas as it stands, you have to have a recheck when you go for your restricted, your full, and then each kind of 10-year renewal after that. And yeah, we do feel as optometrists that that is too big a gap between potentially 18 and 45. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is we know, so potentially in people's 30s that can be a stable time for their eyes, but teenagers and early 20s, there still can be a lot of changes in people's vision. And we know from the patients that come in and see us, and this isn't necessarily from just from having driver's checks, but people coming in and having their eyes tests, people aren't necessarily a good detector of what their vision is like. People will come and see us and feel, oh yeah, no, I'm doing pretty good. And then when we actually do a test, find that they actually are quite blurry. And then when you demonstrate that change in their vision, people can be really surprised. And then once you've got that comparison, right, then, oh, now I can hear you, I was really blurry. And that's kind of the point of the eye test when you're doing that driver's license. It's not just a self-reported, do you think you can see or not.
And so have you received any response from the government?
Not yet, no. So we've made the submission but haven't received feedback on that as yet.
And have you sort of noticed any trends with in sort of eye problems with the younger generation?
Definitely there is an increase in the amount of short-sightedness in the general population, and that's starting younger and progressing more. And that's not just a New Zealand thing, that's a worldwide, mostly developed countries. But as people spend more time inside, more time on devices, definitely we see more and more short-sightedness, which obviously has a huge impact for distance viewing, for driving.
Given that the cost of most basic goods are rising as well, do you think these rising costs would sort of deter young students from getting an eye exam?
Currently the system is that when you go to have your license done, the vision testing isn't done by an optometrist. It's administered at the testing station. There's a screening unit. It's a little box that you put your head in and there's letters to read, and it checks both your far vision and your peripheral vision. Now that's not no screening tool can be 100% accurate, both sensitivity and specificity. As a screening tool, it's pretty good. It has been demonstrated to be pretty effective. Some people will fail that screening and then require a formal testing at an optometrist. And some people may fail that screening, but then when we check them in our rooms, it turns out that they're fine. But I guess when you're looking at thresholds of how people's vision are, you'd rather fail a few people that are okay and then go and get their vision checked and they're okay, rather than have the sensitivity the other way and pass some people who shouldn't be out there driving. So there's always been a little bit of grumbling from people that, right, I had trouble with the test and the machine, and the machine's not very good. If you've got one eye that's very different from the other, chances are you'll always fail with that machine. But the alternative to that is every single person having to go to an optometrist or a GP to have their vision checked. And that's a huge cost and time barrier, both for the population, but also as the burden on time on GPs and optometrists to be checking that scale of people. So that screening method seems to be a reasonable balance at this stage.
So you're saying not necessarily everyone who does that screening process at like a VTNZ, they don't necessarily have to go to an optom?
No. So you go to situ license, if you pass that screening, then you're deemed your vision's good enough and that's fine. And so there isn't an additional charge or time factor for the 90% of people. Actually, I don't know what the percentage is, but yeah, I'd say the majority, yeah.
And my final question to you, Hayden, is what would your advice be for young drivers in terms of taking care of their vision and eye health?
So we still encourage regular eye tests, particularly if you are spending a lot of time up close, working computers inside office environments, can't study, put a lot of pressure on people's eyes and vision and fatigue. We recommend most people have an eye test every under 45. I think every 3 to 4 years is fine. Over 45, the recommendation is every 2 years that you have an eye test for your vision. Because it's also not just about that clarity of vision when we are talking about driving. It's not just that distance. Can you see or not? But it's also peripheral vision is a factor in the driving. And that's one that we're even worse at determining if there's a gap in our peripheral vision. The brain's really good at filling in any gaps that may be there. And while there's only a really small number of diseases that can cause people's peripheral vision to change, such as glaucoma or tumours and taking up space inside the head and the brain, they're obviously very low chance of that happening, particularly in younger people, but if it does, it has real big implications.
Cool. Those are all the questions I've had. Thank you so much for your time, Hayden.
No, all good.
A University of Auckland student I spoke to wasn't in favour of getting regular eye exams. Would you consider getting a regular eye exam in this economy?
No, I wouldn't. And that probably comes down to a few things. One, obviously the cost, right, the elephant in the room. Two, I think a major issue for a lot of students, especially first-year students, is access. You know, a lot of us don't have cars here or our own mode of transportation, so we rely a lot on public transport. And for a lot of people who aren't from Auckland, it's, you know, tricky to figure out what the public transport system is like, to go and, especially when I moved to Auckland, register for an ATO Hop card and figure out how the buses work and go and get an eye exam. So I guess a lot of factors play into whether students are open to go and get an eye exam.
And how much would you be willing to pay for an eye exam if you went for one?
Probably as much as the GP consultation. University Health and Counselling charges, I think it's like 20 per consultation. So around about that much.
And how much would you be willing to pay for a pair of glasses?
Obviously glasses are expensive, so probably more than a GP consultation, but definitely not like over 100 or like, you know, even $80 is really expensive for a student.
However, another AUT student I spoke to said getting an eye exam is a good investment despite rising prices. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Crunchy. I'm a law student at AUT.
Would you consider getting an eye exam in this economy?
Yes, I'd probably consider it. I think we use our phones and like digital stuff so much that it'd probably be a good investment to go get an eye exam.
And how much would you be willing to pay for an eye exam?
I think the most I'd be willing to pay is about $100 for an eye exam.
And the last question to you is, how much would you be willing to pay for a pair of glasses?
If these glasses are prescribed, I would say around 100 and 150, somewhere between that.
And just another question, would you be okay if the government reduced the frequency of eye exams for young drivers?
I think it's good where it's at. I wouldn't really want it reduced, so no.
That was the New Zealand Association of Optometrists President Hayden Trainer on why the government shouldn't slash the number of eye exams and university students on getting an eye exam amid rising costs.
That was The Wire.
Ko e rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Public Service Association National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimons, the University of Auckland's Paul Talon, and President of the New Zealand Association of Optometrists Hayden Trienor, as well as a couple of university students. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.